found the number one internet site for irreverent, cool, and entertaining talk programming. It's LA Talk Radio. We say what we want.
You're listening to the Maria Sanchez Show on LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com. The Maria Sanchez Show, a conversation, not a confrontation, on LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com.
Thank you, Linda O'Brien. Good morning. This is the Maria Sanchez Show. Thank you so much for joining us. It's Tuesday, June 25th. We are live every weekday morning at 9 o'clock at latalkradio.com. And then later for download and listen on demand at mariasanchezshow.com and themariasanchezshow.com. And we've been receiving an overwhelming, kind of surprising response. And I say surprising, I guess, because we started, this is week 10, but the first 2 weeks that we had the program, we were under the radar. I was like, no one needs to know. I just want to make sure we get the kinks out of the system. And since I'm technologically challenged in general, pushing buttons, I've engineered my program before in terrestrial radio, but this is different because this is computer stuff. And so I'm not very good with computer stuff. And not only am I not good with computer stuff, the technology doesn't like me. There are, like, I just downloaded Skype yesterday for the first time because I'm endeavoring to take our program outside the studio, and I need Skype to do that. Excuse me. So Sam here at LA Talk Radio is going to help me figure that out, or to give me a tutorial on how to do it. So I go through the Skype thing, and I'm sure I've never used it, but I'm sure those of you who have know how simple the process is. And I enter all the information in, and I agree to the whatevers, and I hit, you know, click to enter or start and open up an account, and it goes back up to the top of the page where I have entered in my email, and it says email address not valid. And I'm like, no. So rather than just click again, I delete that, re-enter it. That went on 3 times, saying that my email address was not valid. So I go back and I enter my other email address. So I have one that I use professionally and one that I use personally. My professional one is Gmail. My personal one is Earthlink. So I enter in my Earthlink email address. They don't accept that. Twice, they don't accept that. And like, you know what? I can't get a break here. I've entered it 5 different times, 2 different email addresses that are not only current, working, that I use every day, and it's telling me, no, wrong. So I just, like, I throw up my hands in frustration, like, you know what, maybe this just doesn't what it's meant to be. I try and push things through, and so maybe just accept the fact that you can't be a Skype user. So I just go on to other things, and then I come back, and of course, I have to start all over again, because when it's opened an account, it doesn't save the information. And I do it, and I use my Gmail address, and it says, welcome to Skype. So it's those things that get in the way. And so I know it's not just operator error. It's a nice combination of it. So we got our first numbers for the entire month of May, which is our first full month broadcasting here from the great studios in Sherman Oaks at latalkradio.com. And we had some fabulous numbers. And so we just want to thank you for that and continue to listen and spread the word, because that helps us all in terms of momentum. Coming up this hour, we have a guest who is the lead researcher on a study that was released talking about how cancer-fighting antioxidants in our produce, and as in terms of fruits and vegetables, can perhaps be boosted so that it helps us when we ingest them at what time. So she's going to be visiting with us. She's from Rice University, a biologist. Janet Bram is her name. And then later on in the program, we have a woman. She is a neonatal critical care registered nurse in Chicago, Illinois. And she wrote a book called Somebody in the White House Looks Like Me, Thoughts and Poems of Ordinary Black People on the Election of President Barack Obama. And the premise for her book is that when President Obama was elected, everyone was asking black celebrities, politicians, movie stars, and civil rights leaders for their reaction. But did anybody speak to the average blacks whose voices went unheard? So she did that. She says she interviewed black skilled and unskilled workers, professionals, and retirees of all ages from different parts of the country. And before we get into the top news of the day, The Sanchez household is going to have a pet starting tomorrow. I was raised having dogs when in my family of origin, and as an adult, I have never had a dog. And people would say, geez, why not? You know, it's the greatest thing. It's such a good companion, and it would help with your kids in terms of socialization and all. And I was like, I'm too busy raising people that I'm potty training to be able to do that also with a dog. So as much as I'd like to have a dog, and I really would, especially at this time in my life, being an empty nester, and I work out about 6 days a week, and most of that is cardio, which is walking, hiking. What a great companion to have with me, because ordinarily I'm by myself. And so, but then I know myself, I don't want that responsibility. I've spent so many years, as my mother, she goes like this, done that, been there, no thank you. So I've decided that I'm going to take in a kitty. I'm rescuing a kitty that was abandoned, and it's a mommy kitty who had four sons, and they were discovered on the streets with the babies being 3 weeks old. So a big-hearted girlfriend of ours took in the mommy and the four three-week-old kitties and allowed them into her home so that the kitties could get to 8 weeks, which is when they're allowed to be separated from the mommy and be adopted out. Well, that happened on Saturday. There was a kitty adoption at the Camarillo Animal Shelter. And so I said, well, what about the mommy? And she says, well, you know, we're going to adopt the mommy out too. And a great disposition, and she might be a year and a half old at the most, and not a lot of, you know, TLC needed. And not that that is something for me, but I thought, well, you know what, maybe now it's time. It's time. So I'm going to take the mommy. They are fixing her today and microchipping her, and I get to pick her up tomorrow post-surgery. And Maria Sanchez is going to have a pet, and it's a big commitment for me. I was thinking about it yesterday because I babysat my daughter's kitty while she was away over the weekend, so I had her kitty for 72 hours. And as you know, if you've had cats, you clean out the litter box, you make sure there's food and water, and they come and join you when they feel like it. Her cat is a little more skittish because my daughter also rescued the cat, and it had maladies at the time, not only socially but also physically, and some of them are still there. So that her kitty is a little more skittish than I'm hoping the new one is that I'm adopting, which also has the name. My girlfriend gave the name Mercedes to my kitty, and so I'm going to keep that, or Mercedes, I could say also. So I, with trepidation, when my daughter came home yesterday and I took her and her kitty back to school where she goes in Santa Barbara, I was thinking when I came back to the house, it's quiet, it's clean, there's no smell of litter anywhere. What am I thinking? And I thought, it'll do you good, Maria. You can use some day-to-day responsibilities in terms of caring with others. Because I have been home alone, it'll be 3 years in August. And if you're new to the program, I have four grown children. They're all 20-somethings. And my baby's 21, that's my daughter. And it was fast and furious for 20 years, and I loved it. I had two in diapers at most times, and I had four children in 5 years. So it was, as they grew older, you know, I had four in grammar school at the same time for 3 years. I had three in high school at the same time at 1 year. I had three in college at the same time during 1 year. And the doorbell was ringing, the phone was going, the people were coming in. I was always cooking for 10 because we never knew who was going to show up or bring somebody home. And I reveled in it. And then it came crashing to ultimate screeching silence. And it took me months to get over the deafening silence. And I would look at my watch and go, it's 5:10. I've got... No, I don't. I don't have to be anywhere. I don't have to cook for anybody. So like yesterday, I came back from Santa Barbara. I did some more show prep, and the next thing I know, it's like 6 o'clock, and I hadn't worked out yet, so I had some errands to run. I thought I'm going to pop on my one-speed beach cruise bicycle, which I have with a basket in front, and I'm going to pedal my way to my errands, like CVS and the grocery store and the bank and the mailbox. I have a PO box, and I always take the longest way possible so I can maximize my exercise. And I'm pedaling home, and it's like, I don't know, 7:30 or something. I had picked up some organic vegetables. I also had free-range, boneless, chinless, skinless chicken breasts to make. And here in Southern California yesterday, we had what we call June gloom all day. The sun never came out. I almost thought about starting a fire. It felt all cozy, and I thought, ah, great, I'll make some soup. So by the time I sat down to eat, it was like 8:45, but I was keeping myself company and entertained, and I've grown accustomed to that. So Mercedes is going to join. It'll be a two-female household, and that's as of tomorrow. And now we'll get to the news of the day in a bit, but we're going to introduce Dr. Janet Bram. She is the Rice University biologist. Good morning, Dr. Bram. Welcome to the Maria Sanchez Show. Thank you for joining us.
Hello.
Hi.
Good morning.
Good morning. So this research that you were the lead researcher on and the study that was published in Current Biology deals with, is it circadian rhythms that you have detected in fruits and vegetables?
Correct.
And can you give us the backstory about the study that you did last year and then how from that you leaped into this one? And then we'll go into what this one is all about.
Okay. We have demonstrated that plants use their circadian clock to defend against insect attack. So plants are able to know the time of day that insects are most likely to feed. And they use their clocks then to prepare for potential attack even before it happens. So plants are able to accumulate anti-insect compounds at the time of day that insects are most likely to feed, and in that way, the clock helps prepare them against attack before that happens. And so in that way, the clock enhances plant defense against insects.
So did you know that plants had a circadian rhythm when you started last year's study?
Yes. It's been known for years that plants have a circadian clock and that that circadian clock is important for plant fitness. We know, for example, that the plant circadian clock is important to enable plants to anticipate seasonal changes, so to know when the seasons, the days are getting longer or shorter and prepare for changes of the season before they happen. So we knew the clock was there and it was very important. The new aspect of our research is that we tied that clock function to plant defense and plant resistance against insects.
So then from that study last year to this study of this year, you simulated the circadian rhythm for them once they had been harvested?
Right. Well, we realized that our research plant is related to food crops that we eat, like cabbage and broccoli and cauliflower. And if these anti-insect chemicals are accumulating at different times of day, then maybe similar things were happening in our crop plants. And interestingly, these anti-insect chemicals that help the research plant fend off insects have been identified as anti-cancer compounds for humans. And so one reason we're told to eat things like cabbage and broccoli is that they make these chemicals, and these chemicals have been shown to have potent anti-cancer activities. And so our research went into to test the idea that the circadian clock might regulate the levels of these chemicals even in post-harvest cabbage and other fruits and vegetables.
Now, does that suggest that the anti-cancer compounds that they're able to exhibit also have cycles, and so that we should ingest them at the time when they're at the highest?
Our research suggests that, yes, that these chemicals, we show that these chemicals, these particular anti-cancer chemicals, accumulate at different levels at different times of day. And so it may be that if we keep our fruits and vegetables under light-dark cycles, that there are a number of different kinds of metabolites that vary at different times of day, which may then mean that we may want to eat our vegetables and fruits at particular times of day to get the most human health benefit out of them.
So it's not that they're destroyed, it's just that they're enhanced if you follow this kind of day-night cycle?
Well, we only looked at this one particular class of compounds so far in cabbage, and what we find is that there's about a twofold difference.
So it's
There's
double.
Twofold more in the day than there is at night.
So what does that have to do with preparation and cooking? Does that get diminished? So should you be eating raw, or do you know about that?
So I don't know what the effect of cooking is on the potency or levels of these compounds. However, I believe that they are resistant because we know most people eat cabbage and broccoli that's cooked. And these chemicals are known to be beneficial from those crops. And so my understanding is that they are at least somewhat resistant to cooking. I think what our results suggest is that the idea would be that we would keep these rhythms going in our post-harvest fruits and vegetables, identify the time of day at which they're out at their optimal nutritional value, and either eat those at that time or cook them at those times to preserve those levels so that you get the most benefit.
And is this of more importance to folks from the harvest to the storage, or from us from the store to our table?
Well, the crops that are growing out in the field are continuing to have their rhythmic behavior because they are constantly exposed to the changes in light and dark simply from the sunrise and set. And so their circadian clock should be functioning quite robustly. This is probably more of a problem upon once we harvest these crops and then we store them either in constant light or constant dark, mm-hmm. then that will cause a dampening of these circadian rhythms and then a decrease potentially, at least of the peak levels of these nutrients.
And then us as consumers, can we help reactivate their circadian rhythms, do you know?
Yes, well, that's what we were able to do in the lab. We were able to go to the grocery store, get these fruits and vegetables, like the cabbage, and then bring them back to the lab and put them under light-dark cycles and show that we could clearly re-entrain their clocks. We could reactivate their circadian rhythms.
Oh.
And so it's certainly possible to do by simply giving them light signals.
Oh, so I thought you had taken them from the storage or from the field. So you actually were a post-consumer, if you will.
Yes, absolutely.
We would be. Oh, that's even more fascinating. So I would imagine that the circadian clocks of the post-harvest vegetables and fruits may differ depending on if they're a root vegetable or above the ground or if they're a leaf vegetable versus a fruit.
Yes, so we measured these particular chemical compounds that are called glucosinolates that are present in our research plant and are present in things like cabbage and broccoli. But we also showed that things like carrots and blueberries and zucchini and spinach and lettuce, they all show the ability to have their clock re-entrained, reactivated, and they show rhythmic behavior. But we don't yet know what chemical compounds or metabolites might be cycling in those different fruits and vegetables. So cabbage has these one particular class of chemicals, but those other fruits and vegetables that we looked at do not have that same group of chemical compounds. So they must have other metabolites that we have not yet identified, and that's one of the things we want to do in the future.
And so when you refer to these metabolites, you're talking about the anti-cancer compounds?
Well, in cabbage, they're anti-cancer compounds, the ones that we looked at. But what is present in the other fruits and vegetables, we don't know. As you know, many fruits and vegetables have different kinds of antioxidants that have been identified as particularly important for human health.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was one of the things we want to look at. Are there other kinds of phytochemicals that have antioxidant activity in these other kinds of fruits and vegetables that might be under circadian control?
Now, as consumers, how practical is this for us to duplicate what you did in your labs?
I think that we need to do a lot more experiments to know what the best advice would be to give to consumers. So first, we really want to understand whether this effect is significant enough to make a substantial difference in the health value of these various fruits and vegetables. And then we would need to identify what's the time of day that would be optimal to eat or preserve the different kinds of fruits and vegetables. And you may imagine it could be a different time of day for different fruits and vegetables.
Mm-hmm.
So it could get kind of complicated.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot more work for us to do to figure out what's practical and how beneficial would it be. And we also want to understand how to make this practical. We know that plants are very sensitive to different kinds of stimuli, and it may be that just a pulse of light at specific periods of time might be enough to reset the clock.
Hmm.
And so there might be ways to make this simple and practical and then useful.
Now, does this apply to harvesting? Because I don't know what you would call it, but I'm a gardener, so I've got corn and basil and tomatoes and zucchini and celery and et cetera. Does it apply to when you pull it out of the earth too, whether or not you're interrupting it or whether it's at its peak or just beginning?
Right. I think that, again, they're going to, those fruits and vegetables that are still in the field are going to have robust circadian rhythms. And so it may be very different. It may be that the amount of nutrients you get from that particular carrot would be very different if you pick it in the early morning mm-hmm. versus the late in the day. Mm-hmm. And we don't yet know, you know, when would be optimal. But certainly I would predict that there are going to be quite different levels of a number of different metabolites.
I would think so too. Now, yes. Can you share, I had a chance to watch the video of you talking and then some of your assistants or what, I'm not sure what you call your colleagues, putting the items in the lab and et cetera. Can you explain that, what people might not see visually, just through how you can describe how it is that you went about your studies?
So for the video that's online, what we did was we took two lettuce leaves, and one of those lettuce leaves we put under light-dark cycles that were the same light-dark cycles that we exposed the insect to that was going to eat the plant. And so both the plant, the lettuce leaf, and the insects were under the same circadian rhythm. And then we took a second lettuce leaf and put it under opposite light-dark cycles. So its phase was completely opposite. So when it thought it was nighttime, it was actually daytime for the insects. And basically the question was, does it matter if the lettuce leaf knows what time of day it is for its defense against insects? And so what you see in that video is we put insects on both leaves, and we see one of the leaves eaten very quickly and the other one eaten more slowly. And what that shows is that if the lettuce leaf clock is properly entrained with the insect, then the plants are much more resistant. So if the plants know what time of day it is, they can be much more resistant against insects than if they're confused, if they're tricked into thinking it's the wrong time of day.
Now, as a researcher, and you have this hypothesis, and then you actually see it being executed, what is that like for you, personally?
Oh, it's great fun. It's great fun. You make this hypothesis, and this one was a little bit crazy. I mean, we, as plant biologists, we understood that these post-harvest vegetables are really still alive. Their cells are still alive, even though they've been removed from the whole plant. But it was still very surprising to see that we could dramatically affect their biology by just putting them under light dark cycles and get them to re-entrain their clocks and show this significant behavior. So, you know, the thrill of discovery is really great, and I love being a scientist, and I would recommend it to anyone who is interested in this kind of a career. It's great fun to have these kinds of, when your experiments work, there's never a better day.
I would imagine it's like hitting the jackpot. Do you jump up and down and pat each other on the back and high fives and champagne?
Absolutely.
And
yep, there's champagne involved, yes.
That's so funny. And I don't mean this pejoratively at all, but it's like the geek/nerd/way to hit a home run or a grand slam or win the World Series or something. I mean, you're changing.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think that's fascinating. Now, if people don't know what you mean by entrained, will you share what that means and how that relates to jet lag, for example?
Sure. So the circadian clock is this internal clock that nearly all biological organisms have. So it's a way for them to keep time. They can keep track of 24 hours. So they know when every 24-hour period goes by. But we need to entrain that clock. We need to synchronize that clock with our external environment. And so the way that that happens is through light, generally, light or temperature. And so when you live in a place like Houston where I live, my internal clock is synchronized with my outside environment. So when it's morning, when the sun rises, my internal clock also tells me that it's morning. Now, if I fly across the ocean and I wake up in China, my internal clock is still on Houston time, but the external environment is nearly 12 hours different,
mm-hmm.
right? So when I think it's morning, when my body tells me it's morning, the outside environment is telling me it's nighttime. So I'm sleepy during the day and I'm wide awake at night. But if I go out in the sun every day for 3 or 4 or 5 days, my internal clock now readjusts. It becomes entrained to that local environment. And so after about a week, you begin to realize that your jet lag is dissipating. Your clock, your internal clock, has been re-entrained to that local environment. And now when you feel it's morning, it matches the environment, which is morning.
Now, I've heard that it's more difficult to fly, and I don't recall which, east-west versus west-east or something like that. Does that have something, is there, can that be explained with entrainment or how difficult it is to, for folks to adapt?
I don't know the answer to that. I do know, as a plant biologist, I believe that if you give light signals in the morning, it may be easier to get the clock to be synchronized. So it depends on the time of day at which you get your light signals. There might be greater sensitivity of the clock to re-entrainment depending on the time of day at which you get your light signals. Hmm. And maybe that has something to do with why it's easier to get over jet lag in one direction versus the other.
And it's funny because I've traveled fairly extensively, and I have never had an issue with jet lag. I just, whatever I set my watch to, that's how I behave. And I don't know if that means that I am ignorant with what's really going on, or it's like, yep, that's okay, that's whatever it says, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to eat dinner instead of breakfast, and you know that. So
So maybe your clock is really easily entrained.
Oh, I see. So some people, I mean, obviously it has to happen because we have to adjust, but mm-hmm. some people may be more suggestive than others in that regard?
Perhaps. I don't know.
So now what is next? Since this is like two parts of a three-part, or because I know you've got something else on your plate, obviously, based on what you've learned this time.
Yeah, we're taking this research in multiple directions. One is we'd like to understand, we'd like to know what all the different metabolites and nutrients are that cycle in response to the circadian clock in various post-harvest vegetables, to understand whether this is really does have practical, you know, significant possibilities for enhancing health value of fruits and vegetables. And if we show that that is does appear to be the case, then we're also interested in understanding how do we make this practical? What's the least amount of manipulation that could be done to keep clocks entrained in post-harvest fruits and vegetables? And then the other side of that coin is to understand really the basic biology. That is, how does a circadian clock control the synthesis and breakdown of different kinds of metabolites? So that goes back really to our model plant studies, and we're trying to understand how that internal clock controls the accumulation, the synthesis, degradation of various chemicals and hormones in the plant.
And then finally, tell us how the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is involved.
So the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is very interested in enhancing post-harvest crop resistance to pests. And so we propose that one possibility is that if we can keep the clocks running in these post-harvest vegetables and fruits and or other kinds of crops, it may enhance biotic stress. So biotic stress, what I mean by that is infection by insects or fungal infection. And so we're trying to utilize these initial findings to see if there's a practical effect with pest resistance by keeping clocks running post-harvest.
And would that suggest that perhaps we might not need to use as much or any insecticides?
It may be that if we keep the natural resistance of plants up by keeping their clocks robustly functioning, that we may be able to use less pesticides.
So did they give a grant to Rice for follow-up research?
Yes, we were given a Grand Challenges Award to just begin to try to figure out if this is going to be a practical approach. So we're doing that research now.
And are you soliciting matches?
Matches?
In terms of grants? They didn't give a caveat with which they're awarding you the grant?
No, this is a grant that enables us to try to get some strong preliminary data that this approach might work.
Okay, excellent. Well, thank you so much for your time and actually for breaking it down into layman's terms, if you will. Is that an obsolete statement now in the days of PC? I don't know how else I would say that.
Well, this is a study that's pretty accessible, so it's not too hard to help people understand it, I think.
I agree, and I thank you for taking the time. I really do appreciate it.
And you're welcome.
Good
thank
luck
you.
With everything. Dr. Bram, she is a professor and chair of Rice Department of Biochemistry and Cell Biology. And in all fairness, that's the research from Rice University and my alma mater, the University of California at Davis. which is has a huge ag school presence. In fact, I graduated from the College of Agriculture and Environmental Science, and I went to school with folks who were from ranches and farms, and I was like, what do you need to go to school for? And they're like, well, there's a science behind that. Because my mother is from a ranch slash farm where nobody spoke any English, and I think her dad went to the fourth grade. Now, she's ninth of 10, and almost all of her siblings went to college, and some of them even got their master's degree. So talk about a huge change in things. So that was Dr. Janet Brom, the lead researcher on the study that was published in Current Biology about anti-cancer compounds and how we can help enhance those. So in the news today, the NSA leaker story just won't go away. And obviously what Edward Snowden did was illegal. For some reason, I'm rooting for the guy. And I by that, I mean to say that I don't enforce or endorse illegal behavior or activities, but it seems like it was information that we did need to know. Obviously, this wasn't the right way to go about it, and I guess I don't know how you would do it to let us know what's going on. And anytime I have this conversation with most people my age, they go, Maria, it's been going on forever. But I don't think it's been going on to the extent that it has been going on recently. So China and Russia have both rejected our accusations that they helped Edward Snowden, even though he was allowed to leave Hong Kong. And apparently Russia, their foreign minister, is denying suggestions that Moscow helped him in any way, including by allowing him to fly into there. So what he said is he chose his own itinerary. We learned about it from the media. He has not crossed the Russian border. We consider the attempts to accuse the Russian side of violating U.S. laws and practically of involvement in a plot to be absolutely groundless and unacceptable. So his insistence, by the way, this Russian foreign minister's insistence that Snowden hasn't entered Russia suggests that he has not left the airport transit area, because the airport transit area is Russian sovereign territory. So he's traveling on a refugee document of passage provided by Ecuador because the United States revoked his passport. And Jay Carney, the spokesperson for the White House, said it's Washington's assumption that Snowden is still in Russia. The United States is upset that Hong Kong allowed him to leave, even though Washington had asked the Chinese territory to detain him. It has been confirmed that Snowden is traveling with Sarah Harrison, a legal researcher working for WikiLeaks. She came together with Snowden from Hong Kong on June 23rd, about 5 p.m. He had a ticket to go to Havana yesterday, but didn't use it. She also had one, and she didn't use it either. So obviously some of our concerns as a country is how much information and sensitive material did he have, and how much is he going to share? The Kremlin denies knowledge of any contacts between Russia officials and Snowden, although media speculation is that the security forces could be questioning him. So they, as of yesterday, they were referring to him as a 29-year-old. Today, they're referring to him as a 30-year-old. So I guess he had a birthday in the interim. So more trouble for Paula Deen. The celebrity chef has been dropped by Smithfield Foods, which is the global pork-producing company. Their statement, Smithfield condemns the use of offensive and discriminatory language and behavior of any kind. Therefore, we are terminating our partnership with Paula Deen. Smithfield is determined to be an ethical food industry leader, and it is important that our values and those of our spokespeople are properly aligned. Since 2006, she served as a spokesperson for the Smithfield brand, including a line of hams called the Paula Deen Collection. And, of course, this came about during a deposition last month when the woman who is suing both Paula Deen and her brother for racial and sexual discrimination, who worked as a manager of their restaurant, the attorney asked Deen if she'd ever used the N-word, and she said she had. So she's made her mea culpas, and she's done two video apologies, which I've seen one of. And I believe that everybody deserves forgiveness. It's just going to be whether or not she's going to rebound from that. I mean, you see over the years, Joey Buttafuoco and the guy who, the sportscaster Marv Albert, I think it was, or his brother, who chewed on the back of a gal, and then Tiger Woods, and, you know, people are human, and they fall from grace. I think it's just a matter of question is what kind of career might she resurrect after this debacle? And then the Supreme Court keeps weighing in. This is the last week that they're going to roll out their opinions, and they're saving the juiciest and the best for last. They kind of kicked back the case of affirmative action yesterday. They affirmed the use of race in the admissions process, but made it harder for the institutions to use such policies to achieve diversity. 7-1 decision. So that was involving the University of Texas case, which is interesting because the state of Texas automatically accepts to its university's main campus in Austin, excuse me, for in-state students finishing in the top 10% of their schools. So they're saying that ensures a measure of non-subjective diversity. 3/4 of the in-state student body get in that way. So what happens then is there's a separate pool of students trying to get in to the school, and that is the selection process that was before the court, because that process takes in race among other attributes, including GPA, community service, leadership, work experience, which they say is designed to create a diverse campus. Now, here's an interesting statistics. African Americans in Texas as a whole represent about 12% of the overall population, but only make up about 5 or 6% of the University of Texas admissions. So that doesn't even mean attendance. That just means admissions. So they're like at 50% below the population of the state. So the Supreme Court is going to get another chance at this issue this fall in a separate appeal. Excuse me. And I've mentioned I'm a proponent of diversity, and I'll never forget when probably the most diverse workplace I ever worked at was KFI, which is the number one or number two talk radio terrestrial station in the country. And that's where I started my talk show career. And I was surrounded by color, and I was like, you know what, that for whatever reason, I feel like there's a better messaging when we work with what is represented in the world that we live in. And so now we're going to be visiting with our guest, Rosetta Hopkins, who is the author of Somebody in the White House Looks Like Me, Thoughts and Poems of Ordinary Black People on the Election of President Barack Obama. Rosetta, good morning. Welcome to the Maria Sanchez Show. Thank you for joining us. I appreciate your time.
Good morning, and thank you.
And as a neonatal critical care registered nurse in your town of Chicago, Illinois, what the heck are you doing as an author?
Well, you know, we have a variety of skills and talents that we have. And one of my talents and one of my precious desires I've always wanted to do is just write. And so I've always written. I think I've written about 6 manuscripts so far. And I just write and I write and I write, you know, different things. I've written love stories. I've written fictional, non-fictional stuff. So this is one of the books I felt needed to be written.
Well, and what's interesting, I think, about your book is that you said that a lot of famous people were asked, what did it mean to them when President Barack Obama was elected? But you're endeavoring to speak for the average person.
Exactly. That was quite disturbing to me as I watched the election results and they interviewed all the celebs and the civil rights leaders. And I'm thinking there's millions of everyday black people, because it's such a historical event, and most people said they didn't believe it would ever happen in their lifetime. Why wouldn't you ask everyday ordinary people how they felt? I mean, it just as a mix. And the mix wasn't there, and I felt there was a deficit in the interviews, and I felt that this was something I need to create a forum for the everyday ordinary black people in the community to speak to.
And Rosetta, how did you find your subjects to comment for your book?
Well, I started the interviews immediately after the election on November 5th, and most of them were from Chicago for the first question, how they felt about it, because I was interviewing people immediately after the election. And I would just walk down the street, and I would say, and everybody was elated and happy. It was like, I mean, there was excitement everywhere in Chicago, because I guess he was from Chicago. Mm-hmm. He's a black man. So the black community is very exuberant about this. So people just were willing to give me their thoughts at that time. So I just interviewed. I would walk down the street and ask people. I would ask people in stores. I would ask people in banks. Wherever I was at, I would just ask people, how did you feel? I had my little tape recorder with me. So I would just say, you know, speak into the tape recorder and just give me your answers to the question, how did you feel about the election of the first black president? And and I would give everybody the same question to answer, and then they would go on. And what was surprising about the interviews is I interviewed skilled and unskilled and people from 15 to 93 years of age, is that not only were they willing to give me the interview, but some of them also went back, when I asked them what they were thinking about at that time, they went to a historical context. They would go back, the older they were, the further they went back. So if they were in their 60s or 70s, they would go back to the 30s or the 20s and talk about the different discriminations that they had come up against and why they thought it would never happen. All that got mixed into the interviews. So that was very interesting, because I didn't expect that historical turn in the interviews.
Well, and that actually makes sense, because we judge things based on our life experiences. And so the longer we've lived, I would imagine that that would be really poignant, too, to have those stories, like, when I was doing such and such, or when I was this, I never thought that. And one of the things that I understand that you uncovered in your interviewing is that what it meant in other arenas for us as human beings.
So true. Basically this book is for everyone, and it impacts people different ways. I think it impacts black people in terms of how they saw themselves. I think it increased self-esteem. I think it increased the ability that if you work hard and go to school, you can achieve this. Because Obama, I think, for everyone, represents Horatio Alger's story of working hard and pulling yourself up by your bootstraps. Because he didn't start off as a millionaire.
Mm-hmm.
And he pulled himself up. So for white people, I think it's understanding how other people in the country live, because we do live in a diverse world, and our country is very diverse. So understanding how other people live and how they see and things that impact them, and how their lives have been impacted by different inequalities or differences in how they're treated in society, that understanding, I think, helps us come closer together and realize that we're more alike than different. And for people who are arriving in the country, other minorities who are newly immigrants to the country since the 1950s and are just, or 60s, are just setting, looking to build the American dream, the epic American dream, which I think Obama clearly represents, you know, starting with nothing and working yourself up to the top office in our country, I think it highlights that this is possible in America and that dream is possible. So I think it increases their inspiration that they can achieve if they work hard enough and they go to school.
So in other words, they're more empowered because in theory, in America, you can do and be whatever you want to be, or how
exactly.
You work as hard as you want to work and achieve as much success as you want. But in practical application, they're saying, if he can do it, I can do it?
Yes. And even though, and then his life story tells, in studying his journey, it tells what he's come up against. And when you look at the interviews, it tells what the different inequalities that black people have faced in their history as they repeat their history with the discrimination in busing, discrimination in education. And they talk about these things from their past history and talk about the past civil rights struggles. I think this gives you a clear understanding of what he went through to get to that office in terms of his journey. It wasn't just an easy road up to there. And I think that's important for people to understand why it means so much and why it seemed differently to black people, his election as the first black president. And I think everyone wanted it, and I think everyone voted for it, and the country was ready for the change. But for each group, it has a different meaning, yet the same meaning.
Mm-hmm. Tell me, Rosetta, how did you actually go through the process of taking those interviews on your tape recorder and then translating them into a tome?
Well, what happened is I recorded, and I get everybody's permission who was willing to give at the end of the interview, so I would and put the interviews word for word as they gave them to me, not add or take away from them. And that was why I taped the interviews. I asked them at the end of the interview, this is going to be used in the publication of a book, do you get permission to use it? And if they said yes, we, you know, finish the interview off. If they said no, then I erased the interview so I wouldn't accidentally use it in the book.
Mm.
So what happens when I transcribed it, which was a painstaking process of transcribe, playing the tape over and over and recording in handwriting on my computer what each interview was and their backgrounds and stuff. So that was how it was able to move directly from the tape to the book.
And then talk about your poems that you wrote, that you intersperse.
Oh, the poems, you know, I'm a poet, Maria. I'm a poet by heart. And I just have a little muse that pops up periodically. And for this particular project, my muse was very active. Poetry is becoming very important in our society. We can see as rapping is taking place. Rapping is just poetry put to music. And people understand that poetry can say a lot in a very terse, concise way, and that's why the poems were interspersed into the book and put into a chapter. And so what I did was I can give an example of one poem that says a lot. It talks about an entire event without doing 10 or 15 pages, but you get the whole gist of the election. And so it's one of the poems I wrote that was Obama Did It Again. And can I say a part of that?
Yes, please.
Oh, okay. It's about a minute. Obama did it again in 2012. He won the White House again to be president, is what our children will tell. Not by dreams or schemes, he took on Mitt Romney's never-ending slipping and flopping. With the truth in his record, he stood against the barons of wealth who tried to take away the black and Hispanic vote in the Southern Belt. They thought the 47% didn't count and would not come out to vote. So no matter what they said, the meaning of them would not affect the Republicans' chances, they hoped. Women do not deserve equal pay for equal work, Mitt Romney blasted away. I will repeal the Lilly Ledbetter law on my first presidential day. Those gays and Hispanics in our society, I will show them what the white right thinks of their demanding rights. Obama, in his wisdom, said, our country is diverse and all deserve to be counted and heard. Each one and all are Americans who live and love on America's part of the earth. The 10% at the top said, that isn't so. The country is here for our greed and our goals to promote. Obama said, no, it's for all of us to live and to grow. He did it again with ordinary women and men because each and every vote did count and made a difference in who won in the end. That covered the election.
Pretty. That is poetic, too. I mean, just it's poignant, but the fact that you rhyme, but your sentiments are heartfelt. And so tell me, Rosetta, what has your life been like? Are you from Chicago, and how did you choose nursing? And
I was born and raised in Chicago, and my intent was always to leave at some point. I guess it never happened. When you get married and have children, you end up staying. And I've gone through a number of careers before I became a nurse. I'm a certified school teacher, kindergarten through eighth grade. I did a lot of interviewing for different organizations, research interviewing. I was a training specialist for the state for a while, for 3 or 4 years. I worked with an insurance company as a insurance salesman and a mutual funds representative. And I've just gone through a number of careers. You sort of find yourself when you come out of college.
Mm-hmm.
And it was surprising enough to feel that I at least thought I'd be able to be nursing. I went in because I had come out of a divorce, and I needed a job where I could just get on a plane. My intent was to come to California, move my children to California, but I needed to get off the plane and be able to get a job.
Mm-hmm.
And so I actually looked at what skills could I get off the plane and start working immediately without having to be retested and retrained or whatever. And there were only really two fields that you could do that in. Everything else required you to get a new license. And nursing was one of medicine was one of them. And so I decided that was the most agreeable field for me to go into, nursing. And there was a nursing shortage the nursing shortage was coming up at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like you could just, in 1 hour, change jobs 3 or 4 times. You get off the plane and you were working. In fact, you were working before you even got to the city. You could call and be hired ahead of time. So that's why I kind of got, when I got into nursing, I realized I liked it. So it was surprising. I realized I loved nursing. I loved the different patients. I loved helping people. I loved seeing the family's faces when they went home. And when I got into neonatal, it was like this child they've been waiting on for so long. And see this child get healed and then go home to wait a loving family. It's just, I think I have the best job in the world, and other than become a full-time writer. I think it's the best job in the world to do, is to help people and see the smiles on families when they take their babies home.
Because neonatal critical care, you see kind of the worst of the worst.
We do. We get babies from 24 weeks up and through up to full term who have different illnesses and who are born with genetic deformities.
Mm-hmm.
And we work through those with the families. Most make it, or some don't, of course, but majority of them, with our science and medicine advanced to the level it is, we're able to save a lot of those babies, and they're able to go home with their families.
Well, you're an inspiration in and of yourself, let alone the fact that you wrote the book, and it's readily available. Somebody in the White House looks like me?
It sure is. You can get it on Amazon.com. It's sold on BarnesandNoble.com, and you can also purchase from iUniverse.com.
Excellent. Rosetta, thank you for your time and continued success. I appreciate
your story.
Thank you
so much for having me as a guest. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Rosetta L. Hopkins, and she is the author of Somebody in the White House Looks Like Me, Thoughts and Poems of Ordinary Black People on the Election of President Barack Obama. So another inspirational story. We endeavored to do that. This is Maria Sanchez. Hope you're going to have a great rest of your day. Looking forward to visiting with you tomorrow. Leaving you with our jingle.